Hello, this is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's interview podcast. Today, our special guest is Craig Joseph, who is the director of a delightful show called The Cradle Will Rock. Hello, Craig.
Hi, Tom. Hello, everyone listening.
Tell us what got you involved in directing this show.
Sure. I had heard the CD of the show maybe 5 or 6 years ago from a friend who had passed it off to me saying it was something that he thought I'd like, and I hated it at that point in time. I just thought it was really boring and dated, and the music was kind of stale, and so I threw it aside. And maybe about 2 years after that, I was talking to another friend of mine who said, no, you need to go back and give that another listen. It's a show that grows on you. You have to keep listening. So I hadn't sold it yet, and I pulled it out and listened to it, and I guess I started to look a little bit beneath what the show looks like on the exterior and saw that there was a lot of other layers of stuff going on, that it was a lot more complex than I thought, that there were a lot of different musical forms going on in it, that there were not only stock caricature types but also some pretty interesting dramatic characters. And I just kind of got engaged with it, and so I proposed it last year to Whitehorse Theater.
Oh, you did? Okay.
So
you went from hating the show to being its advocate.
Yeah, over about a 3 or 4 year period. I kind of come back to things in cycles. Like, I'll be really interested in something for 2 or 3 months, then I'll let it sit on a back burner and sort of brew in my brain and then come back. And last year when I saw that Whitehorse was accepting proposals for directors and shows that they wanted to direct, I said,
see, folks, this here's a case where we hear that, well, they don't really want proposals for shows, but they do.
Oh, yeah. They do, and they had me write up about a 5 or 6 page document just with ideas that I had for staging and also technical stuff and sort of what was my take on the show, I guess, and why it would be important or interesting to do now.
Well, you know, Whitehorse does terrific work.
Yeah, they do.
They did that Merrily We Roll Along that I hated initially. Even I sat with We Left Believers.
Yeah, they do a great job. It's a really fine young company and really great people to work with. Very high artistic standards and very purposeful about the type of shows they choose and why they choose them, and trying to figure out, you know, why choose these shows over other shows sometimes that everyone else is doing.
And they're smart enough to bring outside directors like yourself. You're not a company member, is that right?
Right. I'm not a company member, and one of the things that's been really, I guess, impressive to me is that the company's been around for 3 years and has already tried to figure out how to not become so, I guess, inward-focused and kind of incestuous with only having their own people do things, but to try and get other voices to speak into what they're doing.
You know, that's a good lesson for a lot of young theater groups that if you know, I can understand using your own people if you've got a few shows in you and if you have people that have directed, but you're right, you have to have that outside, you have to bring in fresh talent.
Great. And what's been awesome for me, too, is in as much as I'm able to bring sort of my slant on things to them, it's also been really interesting to be able to watch a company of people who think differently than me sometimes sort of enhance and influence the way I like to work. So it's just been a really nice, I guess, hybrid of how they've done things in the past and sort of how I've done things in the past, sort of merging into something new.
Okay. I want to ask you now a little bit about your background and also fill us in on what The Cradle Will Rock is about.
Sure. I just have been doing theater ever since I was little, plays on my grandparents' backyard. Went to undergraduate in actually theology and English, but then came to grad school here at Chicago, Northwestern, and did my master's and began a doctoral program there, which I did not finish because I just got tired of school. But I've always been really interested in theater history, directing theory, performance theory, etc. So I'm generally kind of attracted to plays that are a little brainier, maybe, I guess.
And okay, tell us about some of the plays you've directed.
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, I have this thing for Bertolt Brecht and Kurt Weill and that sort of stuff. So I've done the Three Penny Opera before this. I also worked with another group in North Carolina to do The Resistible Rise of Arturo Uy, another Brecht play. So,
wow, that's one I don't know.
Yeah, it's a bizarre little, I guess, another parable allegory type thing that sort of models Hitler's rise to power, but in a sort of comedic, satirical poke fun of how that would sort of thing could happen way.
You'd be open to doing that here.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm not a particularly political person, but I'm sort of engaged with things that sort of comment on human nature and why things work the way they do. And then I've done other stuff all the way, other side of the spectrum, like The Glass Menagerie. I love Tennessee Williams, Eugene O'Neill, American playwrights, and things like that. I've done a couple new plays, one play called Blue Laws in North Carolina. I love working with playwrights as they develop their stuff, too. So
yeah, that can be fun, too. Yeah, but let me ask you about that. How much they say there's a conflict between the playwright owning every word and every line in a play and a director's vision of it. Well, what's been your experience with working with a new play?
Well, I think a lot of my experiences working with playwrights has actually been very pleasant, and I think it has a lot to do with the fact that I was an English major before I got interested in theater, in that I have a very textual approach, I guess, to plays. I love words. I love seeing what the playwright has done and having to try and decipher that. So it's always been kind of a boon to me to have the person who wrote it there in the room.
Most directors would say they want them 5,000 miles away.
No, I actually love having them in the room so that I can ask questions about things that I don't understand. Like, you do something by Tennessee Williams and you start to have conjectures about what he was going for, you know, or you have all these questions a lot of times when you're in school about the, you know, the author's intent and the text. And how.
So true.
So to have the playwright there is great sometimes. And I've been lucky enough to work with playwrights who know that for the first 3 or 4 weeks when we want them around, they should keep saying things, but then also know when it's time to sort of disappear a little bit. And a lot of it is establishing that trust between the two people in the room so that when the playwright leaves the room, they trust you to get up and do what you've talked about.
Also, it helps, I'm sure, to have a little bit of a commanding personality, too, which I detect you have a little. You look like you want to run the show.
I think that I am very collaborative up front. I love to get as many voices in the room and feel like they're being heard and hopefully then gain the trust that when they leave the room, I will take everything that they've said into consideration and then run with it from there. So, yeah.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, trust is important, isn't it? You have to believe in your cast, but they have to believe in you, right?
Right. Absolutely. And I often use the analogy, which was something I kept saying over and over with this cast, particularly, that I feel like my job as the director very often is to sort of define where the playground is and put up the fence so that you don't run in the street and get hit by a car. But once the fence is up, whether you as an actor play on the slide or the merry-go-round or the jungle gym is up to you, just so long as you stay within the fence.
Well said. So let's talk about Cradle Will Rock, where it's at. Give us a little plug for the show, and then let's talk about some of the people that are in it, some of the characters they play, because I just thought the show was terrific. And I did see Timeline Theater's staged reading of it, which, you know, for stage reading was fine, but, boy, I'll tell you what you did. You really made it come to life.
Great. Thank you. Well, the show continues to run through March 25th. And it runs Thursday, Fridays, and Saturday nights at 8 o'clock and Sundays at 3 o'clock. And that's at the Viaduct Theater, which is 3111 Northwestern. And tickets are $20. You can get those online at the whitehorsetheater.org website, or actually .com, whitehorsetheater.com.
Well said. And Cradle Will Rock, tell us who wrote it. And, you know, give us a little historical background for those listeners who aren't familiar with the play or didn't see the terrific film that Tim Robbins did.
Yeah. Well, the play was written by Mark Blitstein during 1936, 1937. He was writing it as part of the Federal Theater Project, which was FDR's program to put actors and technicians back to work during the Depression. The play actually has a really interesting history that has probably gotten it more notoriety than the play itself, in that when Orson Welles directed this first production and John Houseman produced it, the government, just a day before it was supposed to open, basically decided to shut it down. And there are all sorts of conjectures as to why that was. There were all sorts of rumors about communists in the Federal Theater Project, and they were worried a lot about some of the very pro-union sentiments in the play. So the government tried to shut it down, and basically Orson Welles and John Houseman walked their cast, along with their audience for that first night, down the streets of New York to another theater and went ahead and put it on anyway. And a lot of the actors and musicians unions were threatening to, ironically enough, punish the actors or musicians who went ahead in performing it. So
that's a crazy irony. I mean, it's a pro-union.
It's a pro-union play, and they were sort of against it.
They were worried about the government.
Absolutely, yeah. Worried about the government. And I think, in all sincerity, worried about the livelihood of these actors who were already performing for the Federal Theater Project because they were down and out and starving. So the show went off that evening with Mark Blitstein at the piano on stage singing all the parts and doing it until some very brave actors and actresses and musicians in the audience basically stood up from the audience and started doing their parts anyway. And so it's this part of theatrical lore that sort of arts being rebellious and countering a governmental restriction, and they continued to produce it that way for a while, and then it actually enjoyed a run on Broadway.
Yeah, I think it was about a 100-show run.
Over 100-show run when they actually did it later. But that first performance has sort of guided a lot of production since then, where a lot of people are like, let's do it that way, which is why you see lots of concert readings and performances.
Well, what I like that you did was you had your talented piano player with his back to the audience on an upright piano, very similar to that Mark did in the original, correct?
Right. It's pretty impossible to get around that sort of first image when you direct the show. You have to somehow deal with that. You can't just ignore that. So we decided to do that and keep that there. And we also, I think it serves the piece to sort of have all the theatrical machinery right in full view of the audience. It's not a piece where you're trying to create this illusion that people are suddenly in a not real world. So we have actors costume changing on stage, throwing props around. A lot of the cast sits on stage and sort of watches the action and jumps in and out.
And all that works real well. And by the way, Ryan Brewster, if I'm saying he's correct, he is a terrific piano player.
He's a terrific piano player, and he's a terrific music director. Just a really generous with his time, generous with his energies, and just a really phenomenal person. We're a good balance. I'm sort of the commanding, high-strung one, and he's a much more mellow, kind, patient, tolerant one. So, yeah, he's a great pianist. And
so let's talk about the show, about some of the actors and some of the characters they play, because
other than a few, you had a lot of ensemble players play more than one role. Mm-hmm. And I was amazed by the talent level, where they would go from one character, maybe put a shirt on or a hat, and become someone else almost instantaneously, and that speaks to their craft.
Sure. One of the major themes of the play is sort of the duality or double-sidedness of human nature. So we decided to cast everyone in such a way that they would be playing different sides of different people. So, for example, you have Jeremy Traeger in one scene playing a guy who's coming to buy a prostitute, and then 2 seconds later, he's a reverend for a church. And then later on, plays a Polish immigrant who is much more honest and true than this reverend, who has kind of sneaky and malicious and greedy. So we had hoped that the way that we double the characters would sort of cause the audience to start asking some questions about why these characters are
actors. They do, but you know they're different characters, not only by the dress, but they're able to, you know, it's Jeremy Traeger.
Absolutely.
But you see him, different sides of him, and I happen to think he's a real talent.
He's phenomenal. And one of the things that's really fun about this piece, as you mentioned before, is everybody in the cast has a moment to shine when sort of their character comes to the forefront, but there is the play does not go off unless they are strong as an ensemble, because there's so much in the movement and the choreography and the working together and being on your toes.
You did the choreography.
I did, yeah. I did.
And I might say you did a terrific job, not only with the dances, because I'm a sucker for vaudeville. You have a few vaudeville numbers, and you've won my heart. But a lot of that movement stuff you did, particularly the preachers and the way they were reacting to some of the speeches with the head and arm movements and things, was really worked. And, and it just showed the discipline and that the show was rehearsed. Because, you know, that's one of the problems of storefront theater, non-equity storefront theater, is sometimes the shows are under-rehearsed.
Sure, and a lot of that movement and choreography and just general staged blocking for everything, I think really helps give the show the feeling of sort of caricatured over the top that it needs to have. John Houseman called it a political cartoon that's come to life. And so everything we did was sort of trying to push it in that direction.
And it works. I think even Chris Jones of the Tribune thought that it worked. You added another level to it, because sometimes they try and play that show too serious, and it has serious messages, but it's definitely very, very biting, satirical, and needs to have that edge, which you gave it.
It's almost, the show's really interesting, because it's almost something that you need to push so far so that people can see the truth of it. It's almost like if you do it halfway, it gets lost somewhere in between realism and satire, and
absolutely.
It's almost like you push push it so far that it then causes people to almost disconnect from it and start to just ask questions that they might not have if you played it straight for the sort of realistic vein of it.
All right, tell us about the young lady who plays the prostitute and has a couple of big numbers. I think she's dynamite.
Yeah, that's Dana Tretta, and she is phenomenal to work with, just a very talented actress. And the thing that I love about Dana is that she can play a character like Moll, who's starving in this prostitute, and still at the same time simultaneously give you the sense that she's very smart. So that you see the character that she's playing, but at the same time you see Dana, the actress, commenting on the character that she's playing and sort of being able to establish a connection with the audience to guide them through the show as sort of the, if you will, chorus, I guess, or commentator on the play.
Well, one of the things that shows that you are a director, and I mean that as a major compliment, is the characters all seem to, the actors all seem to understand each of the characters they were playing. And many times, you know, talent is talent, but unless someone gives them a focus, you know, they'll play it their way, or they'll be themselves rather than the character. And boy, I'll tell you, you really got them all on the same page. They really did understand what they were playing.
Yeah, thank you. I'm an egghead. I freely admit that. I'm a total brainiac, like overthink everything. And one of the real joys of this cast is having a group of people who ask the same sorts of questions and aren't satisfied to just sort of think they understand what you want as a director, but to try and say, how does my character specifically fit into this overall concept or idea or through line for the play?
And you know what tells me that the cast gets along too, which comes out in the show, is when they were standing on the sidelines, changing costumes, or just sitting in the chair waiting for their next scene, several times I tuned into them and I could see they were really getting into what was going on there. They were laughing where it was funny. They had that look, wow, look at that scene that my fellow actors are doing. Boy, aren't they really knocking it dead. And it was obvious.
Yeah, we've talked a lot about, just as an ensemble piece, when you're on stage, willing what is going on stage to go well, mm-hmm. like putting all of your energy and sort of direction into that. And that's been really helpful. We joke a lot. It's a very eccentric group of people led by myself, one of the most eccentric people of all time. But it's wonderful because I've never worked with a cast that's gotten along so well. And when you have lots of different personalities, you're not ever sure how it's going to mesh.
Well, there's a few that I really like. I thought Ed Rutherford did a terrific job. And tell us about the two fellas who played the artists.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Those scenes were dynamite. And the one with when the girl comes in. So tell us about those.
Graham Kostick and Mark Friedman play Dauber the artist and Yasha the violinist. And it's really interesting in this play, Blitzstein saves his sharpest commentary for the artists, actually.
He sure does. Yeah. And he shows that they were just leeches and mooches, would do anything to get the money from the rich lady.
Right, Mrs. Mister. And they're just the greediest and most corrupt of them all. So that was a really fun number to play with. And both Mark and Graham and Kate, I guess all three of them as actors, are so incredibly inventive that's sort of one of the numbers I look forward to watching each night as we rehearse it, because there's new bits forever creeping in. We'll be at the last night of the show, I'm sure, and they'll be adding something new that fit. But they understand what has to happen in that number, so I'm never worried about it going too far a piece. It's very much what I was saying about the fence. They know where the fence is, so however they play within that, you know, I'm happy.
Well, their talent shows, because, I mean, these are very funny numbers, and they're really in-your-face satire, too.
Yeah.
And they're cute. They're just so well danced. How much rehearsal did you do on the dancing? Or let's balance this, which is a director's dilemma. When you need a triple threat, do you get the singer first because they all have to sing, the actor, the dancer? I mean, how do you do that? Tell us about that process, because I think you got it right.
Well, what was really fortuitous about this audition process is we didn't even audition people for dance. We only auditioned people for you know, their singing abilities and their acting abilities, and even more weight probably than I as a director would traditionally give to singing, because it's mostly a sung show. There's not a whole lot of dialogue in there. So we were just fortuitous in that we also by luck got people who could move, because my original conception when I was thinking about this was not that there would be as much dancing or choreography, and I'm not a trained dancer. I mean, I've been in musicals where I've had to dance and taken 2 years of tap, but there's no tap in the show. So we just really lucked out with that. But
it shows you that you know about choreography, because you did some clever bits that I was looking in the credits for the choreographer, because, you know, there are shows where they have a little dancing, but you don't need a choreographer because it's an obvious little shuffle or whatever you're doing. But this stuff was pretty smart.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think the thing that we looked for number one when we were doing this were people who could this is going to be kind of counterintuitive. I think I put a lot of weight on people who I felt could act, because I knew that they weren't going to have a whole lot of time to traditionally act as we know it in terms of saying lines and doing scenes. So we're going to need people who were going to be able to do that while singing and while moving.
And you did that. So they had to sell the song in character.
And be versatile. And know how to play three or four different characters pretty broadly, pretty quickly, and get across a maximum amount of character information with a minimal amount of stage time. You don't see any one character for more than about 10 minutes.
Yeah, it's a remarkable piece that Blitzstein wrote, where it's everybody has their moment. You know, most shows, you hope for, too bad I couldn't have seen more of that character. But this is one of the geniuses of the show. Not only did he get all his points across, but he certainly gave everybody a chance. I mean, you want to be in that show, there's no small part.
Sure, and I think probably it was additionally helped by the doubling and tripling, because I was thinking for a while, it's like if we did this with just everybody playing one part, literally you would be on stage for 5 or 10 minutes and that's it. What I like about the way that it's worked out now is you get to see actors several times over the course of the evening, even though they're then playing different characters each time.
And I think one of the fellas that had one of the biggest varieties was, and I don't have his name handy, he played the policeman and he played the young boy at the beginning.
John Watts, sure. Yeah, he plays Virgil, who's the cop, and then Junior Mister, who is Mr. Son.
And they did some ensemble stuff. But, I mean, he totally reinvented himself.
Oh, absolutely. The funny thing about him, he's got some of the craziest costume changes in the face of the world, too. He's got, like, underdressed. But, yeah, he goes from being this sort of loud, brash, Steel Town, USA cop to being a stuck-up, spoiled, rotten kind of little boy in knickers and knee socks. And he's a phenomenal character actor. Just can play pretty much anything you throw at him.
Yeah, he's strong. And tell us about the labor leader, the strong character that Blitzstein has. I thought his performance was great. That is
Larry. The character is Larry Forman, and the actor is Jeff Plitt. And Jeff actually has a background in improv, is where most of his stuff has come. So this is sort of a different thing for him to have lines in front of him and moves that are kind of set. And so,
how did he take to that? Sometimes improv people, you got to hit him with a stick.
No, Jeff is great. Jeff is probably one of the most tenacious actors I've ever met in terms of just running and making sure he's gotten his bit and asking really great questions. Like, so much of what he has as Larry Forman in that dialogue is stuff that is the most dated material.
He's the polemic.
It's the most dated material in the play. So first off, just having to understand in the context, what the heck am I saying? I mean, he talks in a lot of colloquialisms and things like that too. But then to say, okay, so what about what I'm saying is now transferable today? And though it's not necessarily the pro-union sentiment, the idea of getting up off your duff and doing something and caring about something and having compassion and caring about justice and equality, how do you capture that energy from an artist even when he's saying things about the union that might not apply? And I think he does a beautiful job of that.
Okay. The Cradle Will Rock has some terrific harmonies and ensemble singing. Who did the arrangements for that?
What's very interesting is Blitzstein's score has a lot more unison singing than you would expect. There's not a whole lot of harmony written in there. So Ryan, where we wanted to add harmony, went ahead and sort of wrote them himself. So he, on a lot of the Amen chorus sort of stuff, and in some of the songs where there are harmonies.
Cute. Yeah, he put that in?
Yeah, he sort of added.
That's not out of the original.
A lot of the stuff is in unison, actually. And a lot of, if you listen to several recordings of The Cradle Will Rock, you'll find that other companies have done that also, found places for, especially some of the Liberty Committee harmonies that they sing together. But that's not stuff that's in Blitzstein's original score.
Oh, well.
He's generally a music director.
That's good.
Yeah.
Tell us about Mr. Mrs. Is it Mrs. Mister?
Mrs. Mister. Yeah.
Whatever.
The names are very confusing. One of the things that was really fun. Bill Zorn is the actor who plays Mr. Mister, and had just a really dead on instinct from the beginning that around so many caricature over the top types, it would really be interesting to underplay Mr. Mister, because it's very easy for that part to become this just nasty monster that sort of chews up the scenery and is as over the top as all those people who are afraid of him. And when you underplay it, as Bill is doing it, it makes it much more believable that somebody this subtle who was able to manipulate could actually get people to be on his side, because he's not this very obvious type of evil. It's kind of like we talked a lot about Hannah Arendt when she wrote Eichmann in Jerusalem, her account of the Nazi world trials, talked a lot about the phrase of the banality of evil and how evil can sort of just like live next door to you and sort of be your neighbor. And
that's the way his character came out, because I thought he was fascinating in that, because I have seen that play. Just, you know, you might as well be a stormtrooper.
Right. And what I love about it is he could, on some level, just be your dad. But every once in a while, you start to see how he knows exactly how to twist people. And then what I love about Kate Brown, who plays Mrs. Mister, in contrast to that, but also along the same line, is she's delightful. You would want to spend an evening with this kind of upper crusty kind of, we described her sometimes as sort of like a rich Edith Bunker, in that she's a little...
Yeah, that's a good. I like that.
Yeah, just a little dotty and kind of sort of not there and there. But what's wonderful about Kate is Kate establishes this rapport with the audience that when she's trying to get people to sell out to her husband, she's completely friendly, but you can see in the way that she interacts with the audience that she knows exactly what's going on. So she does a great job of kind of putting an ironic spin on what she's doing. That's sort of a secret between her and the audience.
Now, let me ask you, why, other than a well-sung, funny musical, why should young people come see this show? See, I think it's got an appeal to young people. It also certainly has an appeal to lovers of Broadway musicals and those who really like classical shows, in the sense that it's a late 30s show. But why should this show? Why does this show have such a nice appeal to the young people? Which the reaction of the younger people in the audience at the show I was at opening night, they really like the show.
Yeah, I think I think there is something among people of my generation in their 20s and 30s where there's this sort of idealism about wanting to return to things that are truthful and good and striving after equality and justice and compassion and trying to get out of a frame of mind where we only think about ourselves. So I think one of the reasons it's popular is that, A, it's a good reminder of how sometimes we can all give in to the things that we think we want, status and comfort and wealth. And
yeah, that's the main theme is don't sell out.
Right, right. And it's very easy for all of us to do because, I mean, you know, like I'm, you know, we're doing this interview in my cousin's apartment where I'm house sitting because I don't have an apartment. And I would love to have, you know, a place to live right now and be making a lot more money than I currently am and have my own place and not have to just move from house-sitting job to house-sitting job. And I'm as susceptible to the desire for that sort of lifestyle as anybody else. But I think there's something in our generation that wants to do something more significant and to believe in something and to strive after something and to have principles that are other-centered rather than self-centered. And I think that's what the appeal is.
And, of course, people do like an inexpensive. I mean, it's only a $20 ticket, is that right?
Right.
And I'll tell you, folks, you know, I cover everything, and a lot of the downtown shows that I see for $75, $80, you can take three people for the price of one of the downtown shows to see your show. And you know something? They're going to like your show better because it's funnier and it's very, very polished.
Well, and if they're actors, you can take six of them because Thursdays and Sundays are industry nights, and they're half price with headshots and resumes. So if you're an actor or a musician or a producer or a director and you have a headshot or a resume every Thursday, every Sunday, you bring that and you get your ticket for $10. You take six for the price of three.
Well, we do get a lot of actors listening to our podcast. And let me ask you this. This is a question I like to ask all directors. How much say did you have in the casting? Sometimes when you're a hired gun, you come into a theater group. Yeah, you have a vision of it, and you may have a few people, but the theater group usually has an ensemble, and I've known some directors who have walked away from deals because they couldn't pick the people they want, or a few key people, you know, screwed it up. They had the wrong people in, and they were forced into it. How did you deal with that, and how do you generally deal with it?
Sure. White Horse has been great. Ryan, the musical director, and I had final say on everything. Danny, a member of the company who is our producer, sat in auditions and sort of gave input, but we didn't run into any major snags that I think we would have even disagreed, and had we disagreed, they would have yielded to us unless there was something major. So it's been very pleasant in that regard. And I've been lucky to not have bad experiences along that case. Every company that I've worked with as an outside director has made their company members audition the same as anybody else.
So if they're the right ones. I mean, all things equal, you want to use a ensemble member if they're the right ones, because
right.
They're a known quantity.
It's a known quantity, and Dana is an ensemble member and has been fabulous to work with and great. And
how many ensemble members are
Dana? Dana's the only one in White Horse, and we had some other people audition who had been in other White Horse shows but aren't company members. So yeah, it was very
well. The funny part of it is I saw a few who will be nameless who are in the company who were in I Sing and Merrily We Roll Along that were there, and I was kidding myself, how come you guys aren't in the show? And you know they said we weren't the right ones for the show.
Yeah,
I don't have a problem. I'm here to supporting it, and you know, and I'm looking forward to a terrific show, which shows a big lack of ego.
Mm-hmm.
Which is refreshing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's absolutely. And they were there opening night to support it the same as anyone else. It's a lovely company. It really is.
In the interest of time, because we're getting near the end of this, what's the future like for you? What have you got going, and what would you like to do in the next 6 months or year?
Sure. I am taking a break right now because I came out of another show right before this. Ryan was starting to rehearse music while I was in Tech Week for another show that I was directing, and so I've just been done two back.
What did you just do?
Over the River and Through the Woods, which is up in Des Plaines with Big Noise Theater Company.
You know, they do terrific stuff, and I've seen that show a number of times. But it's a terrific show. You did that,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, I did that. And so I'm going to take a little break and just rest for a bit. I'm right now talking with Ryan, my music director. We're going to direct, hopefully, for White Horse next year. So we're in the process of picking some potential shows for that season. So that's coming up. And then I've been working on a screenplay, actually, that I'm going to try and finish in the next few months. So I'm going to be doing a little writing, finishing that. I have about 30 pages left to go, and I've been trying to option that with a production company out in California. So.
Wow, that's great. So you like to do the writing, too. Well, a lot of people like to write for film and television. That pays the rent so that you can do these artistic things. The Cradle Will Rock is a dynamite show. I think you've done a terrific job.
Thanks.
And, folks, Craig Joseph is one of those directors that you can do that. If you see his name on a show, go see it because He knows what he's doing.
Thanks.
And that will be all for this section. We'll see you next time. Thank you.
Thanks, Tom.